Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome. We are delighted to welcome you to today's event hosted here at National and Kapodistrian University of Athens in collaboration with London School of Economics and Political Science. We will begin with the opening remarks. I now invite Professor Aristidis Samitas, Vice Rector for Finance and Development, to take the floor for the opening remarks.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Athens. Welcome to the Rector's House. It's a great honor for me to be here with you. Dear Professor Vasilis Monasteriotis, Chair of the Hellenic Observatory in LSE, dear Professor Bajokas, dear Professor Luca Cacelli, dear Professor Panagiotis Petrakis, Chair of Center of Economic Policy, dear Professor Dimitris Kenourios, Member of the Council, dear Chair of Department of Economics, Professor Yorgos Dotsis, dear colleagues, dear Chair of the Board of National Bank of Greece, Professor Gikas Khardouvelis, it is a great pleasure and honor to welcome you today to the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens for this lecture organized by the LSE, Center for Research on Contemporary Greece and Cyprus, the Hellenic Observatory, in collaboration with our university. Today's lecture addresses a subject that is both timely and strategically important. It's about critical raw materials, European autonomy, technological transitions, and economic growth. Critical raw materials may appear at first glance to be specialized industrial or technical issue. In reality, however, they are at the very center of some of the most important transformations of our time. They are essential for the green transition, for digital technologies, for energy security, for advanced manufacturing, for defense capabilities, and for the broader competitiveness of the European economy. The technologies that will define the coming decades, renewable energy systems, batteries, semiconductors, electric mobility, artificial intelligence, infrastructure, and other advanced industrial applications, all, of course, depend on secure and sustainable access to specific materials. Without them, technological transition remains, of course, incomplete. Without them, Europe's ability to innovate, produce, and compete is very constrained. For this reason, the debate to now on critical raw materials is also a debate on Europe's strategic autonomy. It is about Europe's capacity to shape its own development path in a world characterized by geopolitical uncertainty. Supply chain disruptions, technological rivalry, and growing competition for so many resources. But autonomy should not be understood as isolation. For Europe, strategic autonomy must mean resilience, openness with safeguards, stronger industrial capabilities, and the ability to participate in the global value chains for a position of strength. It also means investing in knowledge, innovation, human capital, and of course, regional development. This is a crucial point. The availability of resources alone is not sufficient. What matters equally is whether countries and regions have the capabilities to transform resources into value. Research capacity, financial instruments, industrial ecosystems, skilled labor, of course, institutional quality, and effective governance. In other words, the questions is not only where resources are allocated, but also how they are integrated into productive systems that generate innovation and sustainable growth. This is where universities, our university, University of Athens, have an important role to play. Universities, as you know, are not simply observers of technological and economic transformations. They are actively vehicles, contributors to all these. They produce research, train the next generation of scientists and professionals, support innovation, ecosystems, and contribute to evidence-based policy. They also provide the interdisciplinary space that is necessary for understanding complex transmissions such as one we are discussing today. At the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens, we increasingly see our role in this broader development perspective. As Greece's largest and oldest university, we have a responsibility not only to educate and conduct research, but also to contribute to the country's productive transformation, to support international collaboration, and to participate actively in the major European debates of our time. As Vice Rector of Finance and Development, I would also like to underline the financial and investment dimension of this agenda. The green and digital transitions are not only technological projects, they are also major investment projects. They require long-term financing, public-private cooperation, effective capital allocation, risk-sharing mechanisms, and coherent development strategies. This is particularly important for our country. Our country has strong human capital, a strategic geographical position, a developing innovation ecosystem, and significant opportunities in energy, logistics, technology, research, and education. The challenge is to translate these advances into sustainable investment, higher value-added activity, and long-term growth. In this context, the discussion of critical raw materials is not distant from the Greek economy. It is connected to industrial policy, energy transition, regional development, research capacity, and Europe's wider strategic positioning. It also raises an important question for countries like Greece. How can we contribute to Europe's technological and strategic resilience, which also creating new opportunities for investment, innovation, and inclusive growth? This is precisely why today's lecture is so valuable. It brings together economic geography, innovation studies, economics, finance, and development policy. These are issues that cannot be understood through a single discipline. They require dialogue between universities, policymakers, industry, and of course, institutional financial companies. We are especially honored today to welcome Professor Simona Iamarino, one of the leading scholars in economic geography, innovation, multinational enterprises, local economic development, and regional innovation system. Her work is something that Professor Vasilis Monastiriotis will be in detail later on, has significantly advanced our understanding of how globalization, technological change, and regional capabilities interact. Her perspective is particularly important because it helps us connect the global discussion on strategic resources with the territorial and institutional realities that shape economic development. We are also pleased to welcome today Professor Antonis Bartzokas, Professor of Economics at the University of Athens, and Research Associate at LSE and Director of the International Economics and Development Laboratory. His academic and policy experience, including his work on growth, structural transformation, finance and development will add an important and highly relevant dimension of today's discussion. So let me say now that our university is so glad having all of you today in this debate. I'm confident that today's discussion will offer valuable insights into one of the key challenges that we are facing in Europe, the new economic future coming. With these thoughts, it is of my great pleasure to welcome you to Athens, LSE Athens Lectures, and I would like to welcome Vasilis Monastiriotis and ask him to join me here for a few more details. Thank you very much for being here with us.
Right, a big thank you also from my side for joining us today for the third of the LSE Athens lectures in this academic year. Before I say a few introductory remarks introducing the topic and the speakers, Professor Samitas obviously did a great job taking us to the significance of the topic. I want to say something about this institution that we have established, thankfully, in collaboration with the University of Athens, the LSE Athens Lectures. So the Hellenic Observatory, I've said that from this podium before, but let me repeat, the Hellenic Observatory is taking a lot of pride in being this conduit that brings the significant work that is being done at the London School of Economics, bringing it to Greece. Obviously, LSE has a very good reputation, if you want, and visibility in Greece, but we are particularly proud as Hellenic Observatory that we are the ones who facilitate this and can organize events like this where we bring really, truly global excellence in research that is done at the London School of Economics and from colleagues at the London School of Economics, bringing in to a debate in this room, but also we hope fertilizing, if you want, the public policy dialogue more generally on issues that are not always high up in the agenda. And this speaks to the research that we have lined up as a research center at the Hellenic Observatory. We work on all topics on industrial policy, from the high level, European industrial policy, and how it translates to the Greek case, to very more micro questions about where the money from state aid goes and how much support for the tourism and the real estate sectors may be creating adverse incentives for productive investments in other parts of the economy, which are obviously more, or perhaps more productive, but definitely more extrovert, and so forth. But also on wider issues from the labor market, the new unemployment, designing a new unemployment benefit system in Greece, or looking at the question of rebrain, questions about the impact of AI on the labor market, all the way to wider societal questions about the political fragmentation. We have projects looking at the behavioral and attitudinal aspects of the political fragmentation in Greece and how it maps to developments happening across Europe and beyond, but also to more ideational and societal issues, something relating to values. For example, we have an ongoing developing project on what we call as everyday sexism and how that affects wider beliefs about the role of women in economy, in society, and so forth. So the Hellenic Observatory is trying to develop all this evidence base that we like and who have always communicated to audiences in Greece, both public audiences and policy audiences, and your presence here, both the people in the audience in general, but also of the professors and the distinguished guests that Professor Samitas welcomed. Your presence here helps us to have more effective communication of this evidence, academic evidence that we produce and translate into policy recommendations. Now, within this context, our lecture today about critical raw materials in the European Union and the implications is really delivered by perhaps the most appropriate person to deliver this lecture, my very good colleague and friend, Professor Simona Iamarino. Simona is a professor of applied economics at Gran Sasso Science Institute in Italy, a very well-known graduate social science center in Italy, but she's also affiliated in the Department of Geography and Environment at LSE, where she spent just over 20 years, I think, as professor of economic geography. Professor Iamarino is a fellow of the Regional Science Association International and also elected fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences since 2017. She is one of the most prolific academics in her field, with important contributions in international business, on multinationals, foreign direct investment, in economic geography, from topics on regional development, global production networks, and so forth, and the economics of innovation on things like industrial policy, technological change, and obviously critical raw materials. She has a long number of accolades. I would take you all the way to the wine reception that follows this lecture if I had to list all her accolades, but I would just mention that she is a member of the Executive Board of the Regional Studies Association. She has served as member of the Executive Board. She is Vice President of the Italian Society of Economics, and she is appointed member of the European Commission's High-Level Group on the Future of Cohesion Policy. In 2024, she was awarded the ERSA, European Regional Science Association, European Prize in Regional Science, arguably the highest prize in regional sciences, and the Giacomo Beccatini Prize by the Italian Society of Economics and Industrial Policy. Her work on critical raw materials is not very common for an economic geographer, but it is really both important and groundbreaking. As we will see in her presentation, her work has introduced the concept of material-based technological regimes, a concept that connects technological capabilities to the physical natural resource constraints, and the question of how these may constrain frontier innovation, patent generation, and ultimately regional development and international competitiveness. These are important questions that haphazardly asked at the European level, and I'm concerned that they're not at all asked at the national level here in Greece, so it is very important to have this discussion here today. With us as a discussant, as Professor Samitas mentioned, we have my also very good colleague and associate at the Hellenic Observatory, Professor Antoni Baltzokas. Antoni Baltzokas is a professor of economics here at the university, but he has a long and distinguished career working both at academia but also interfacing with industry, if you want, and he is very, very well positioned to speak both languages and to connect the two worlds. Not only that, but he's also, of course, has long expertise as member of as board director at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, so he knows academics, academia, he knows industry, he knows policy, he's very well placed to lead us in the discussion. So without taking any more of your time, it is a real pleasure to be hosting Professor Iamarino and Professor Baltzokas for this LSE Athens lecture today. So thank you for your attention, and please join me in welcoming to the floor Professor Simona Iamarino.
Well, first of all, I am really honored to be here, and thank you all for coming. It's really a great pleasure. Thank you to the University of Athens, to my old friend Vasilis, and another old friend that will be my discussant, Antoni. And I have other friends actually in the audience. Athens is one of my favorite cities in the world, so I'm always happy to be in Athens. It's a great city. So after all this introduction, I think the expectations are quite high, and I hope that I will deliver what is expected. And it is interesting that Vasilis said it's not a typical topic of economic geography. It isn't, in fact. And when I started with this idea 8.5 years ago, I got a small grant from the sticker funds at the LSE, Department of Economics, because somebody there thought that it was a good idea. But all my colleagues in the Department of Geography and Environment were asking, critical role what? What are you studying? What is this stuff? It really matters? And I insisted, and I believed, and this is my latest passion in research, and I hope that I convince you that this is actually very important stuff. So, let's see if I can... Okay, page down. Yes. So this presentation is very quickly, what are critical raw materials? What are technologies associated with critical raw materials? And some examples of my own specific research lines on this that looked at, for example, energy transition and domestic production and how critical raw materials shape competitiveness. And all this in order to give you a sort of overview of what me and my small research teams, mainly done by LSE PhD students, ex-PhD students that are now around the world in terms of, and have a very good academic career, and then moving to the EU strategies on these topics and expressing some opportunities and some worries about this. And preliminary conclusions. So, why critical raw materials? Well, as has been said in the wonderful introduction that I had today, critical raw materials are called as spices, vitamins for the industry transition, and in particular, actually, for the dual transition, technological transition, both digital and green. They have specific properties, electrical, chemical, mechanical. They are used in tiny, tiny quantities, but they allow properties that otherwise are impossible to reach. They are characterized all by a growing, exploding demand at the worldwide level, precisely because without them, we cannot go ahead in these transitions, and also are characterized by a series of problematic aspects such as geological concentration of the deposit, geographical concentration in some places on the planet that are characterized by institutional weakness, sometimes conflict, wars, and, situations that do not allow very easy supply chain and international trade. And these risks are, in fact, growing. So these are some of the applications that you see. We all read on the newspapers, lithium and cobalt are crucial for batteries or electric vehicles, but in reality, there is a huge range of technologies and products that are relying on critical raw materials that are many more than lithium and cobalt. Okay, the relevance. Well, the relevance has been growing enormously in the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years from the, Energy International Agency, European Commission, African Union, G7, G20, everybody's talking about. At the same time, we have seen that, there are tariffs war exploding on this critical raw materials, and in particular, the trade war between the US and China. And we can see news on the newspapers all the time about this tension and a global geopolitical environment that is fighting for control of these resources. Now, As I was saying, it's not only a matter of lithium and cobalt, okay? I will show you later on the lists, but in any case, you can see that there are a lot of applications. They are not necessarily only batteries or the usual suspects, but, I mean, medical instruments, sophisticated X-ray, and many other advanced products are actually containing and are using the technologies that incorporate these materials. So how we study these critical raw materials? Our concern, and my concern, since I read an article on The Guardian in 2015, I think, but I was head of department at that point, and so I really couldn't start a new line of research. It was technological innovation. When I read this article about the extraction of coltan, that is a combination between columbite and tantalite, and is absolutely crucial in microprocessors and semiconductor, I started thinking, how can I measure that? How can I look in innovation dynamics? And so the most obvious thing was to look at patents. And so we started, and I'll show you how, to look into patents text. At that time, when we started 8.5 years ago, it was possible with natural language processing technique to look and scan the patent text, to look for keywords that were obviously my critical raw materials. Nowadays, we use more sophisticated techniques that are AI generated, so large language model, which actually are more accurate, okay? The research questions, some of the research questions that we try to ask answer in our paper are, which technologies relies on which critical raw materials? How does the critical material supply influence countries' competitiveness, both in technology and in trade? What are the current EU strategies and challenges? Which places? I'm an economic geographer, a regional economist, so I'm always thinking about which are the benefits, which are, you know, the costs, and how they are distributed in place. So which are the places that benefit? Which are the places that lose? So let's start with the first question. Which are the technologies that rely the most? Okay? We use patent data, different patent data, as I was saying, right? I mean, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, PatStat. And actually, in the last year, I have been working on the China National Intellectual Property Administration patents in Chinese. Obviously, I have a Chinese co-author who worked with me as a PhD student at the LSE and now is in Shanghai Tech. And so, you know, isolating different materials and looking at the long-term technological trajectories, right? So we integrated a lot of data sets, not only patents. We used for critical raw material deposit and reserves. We used a range of sources like the U.S. Geological Survey, British Geological Survey. We recently also acquired a privately owned data set, S&P Global, that gives also the state of the mines, export from the usual data sets, firm level, Orbis IP, Orbis cross-border, a lot of data, big data set, where we are, you know, working still at the moment. Technological dependence. This is just an impressionistic picture that tells you and shows you these are the big technological classes, okay? And you can see that, you know, obviously metallurgy is a class of technologies that relies by definition on critical raw materials, but then, you know, there is dependence and links between these big technological classes and different materials to a different extent. So heterogeneity in material dependence across the technologies. So precisely, I mean, there is also textiles production and technologies that are relying on some of these materials. So these are long-term trends as they appear in patents. We had a long validation of the phenomenon we were able to capture. We went back to histories of technologies and were able to validate that our methodology had, you know, a 1% degree of uncertainty or error, but it was very precise. Patents was actually a very, very good, you know, measurement of this material. So here you have, you see, I mean, 40 years from 75 to 2015, overall technologies are growing that mention at least one of these materials over time. And this is 2015. This was just the first chart that we produced. And now we are, you know, 2024. You can see, so we have until 2024, and you can see that, you know, the rate of growth is increasing. Here we have also technological, here was actually on a group of rare metals, okay? So not all of the critical raw materials are many, contrary to what people think. In the current list, individually, are nearly 60 and more, actually, because the lists change according to what is felt to be strategic. These are exercises that have been scanning more than 5 million patents text, whole text. So it was a long, and also in terms of computer power, a huge exercise that took. And you can see that, you know, there is, yes, lithium and cobalt, but even more important are metals like gallium, germanium, molybdenum, various rare earths, and so on and so forth. So you can see the trends, and the trends are really impressive, okay? We study, obviously, using theory. I'm an academic, and it's always very important to find a theoretical framework that gives the possibility to generalize your results. And we use the notion of technological regime that is one of the theory most powerful in explaining the directions of industries. And, you know, there are three important principles. Every shift in industries is given by these three important elements: the knowledge base of the industry, the technological opportunities, and the appropriability of the returns of innovation. And we saw that, in fact, critical raw materials that are changing a lot and impacting a lot of industries respond exactly to this. So the knowledge base is changing in response of, for example, a new material that emerges, or more often, the use of an old material already existing, but in a new way. And it's material sciences that drive this process, okay? Obviously, the emerging or new user of old materials open up new technological opportunities, new functions, okay? Lithium-ion batteries, right? That, you know, substitute the old ones. And then, obviously, what shapes the appropriability of the returns is the availability physically of these materials, okay? And all this goes under the notion of technological paradigm. We are in a moment historically of technological paradigm shift from mechanization, right, to automation, to ICT. Now we are in the greenification. Greenification AI is, you know, still not set in iron what the future exactly will be. This is an example of what I was saying, in fact. You can see here the share of patents, the blue line shows renewable energy technology compared to all the other technologies. And you can see how renewable energy is far more reliant on these materials than all other technologies, okay? So this is a point that really we can see that our green transition and all the various, you know, technologies and products, solar panel or wind turbines, need these materials in big quantities, right? We all know cobalt and lithium in batteries, but gallium and germanium in integrated circuits are fundamental. Tantalum in capacitor, molybdenum in transistors, and so on and so forth. So this is not a new story in human history, okay? Because the evolution of, for example, solar photovoltaics is grounded in Einstein's work on semiconductor materials. That, by the way, I was very impressed reading about material world, that sand, the sand on our beaches, is in fact full of silicon. And this is why also a lot of beaches in the world are actually shrinking. So this is relevant both for for Greece and for Italians, right? So how does critical raw material influence nation-state competitiveness? And this is the case, again, of the renewable energy. This is a clarification that is very important because I see also on newspapers that it's not really understood. And so I got an historical example in order to understand what is the difference between extraction and production of critical raw materials. So in the material world by Ed Conway, I found the fantastic, fascinating story of Swansea in Wales, in England. A port that, you know, although didn't have a single gram of copper under their own ground, became the world major producer of copper during the whole 19th century, where copper was shipped from all over the world to be processed and transformed in Swansea. And this is a story that makes us understand, okay, for a combination of locational advantages that Swansea had, close to coal mines, a big port, water in abundance, and attracted inventors, attracted engineers, that, you know, the invention of the reverberatory furnace for the processing of copper, and became a hub. Now, this has been well understood by China, that not only is rich naturally by critical raw materials, but in reality controls and started to control long time ago the materials that they don't have, okay? China today is the world processor in chief. And here is, in a short, just a chart, you can see These bars are the difference between the natural, critical raw material production minus the reserves at home. And you can see how China has much more production than what it owns under the ground, while other, also European, countries reach, right? Poland, for example, but also you can see Canada, US, are in deficit, not because they don't have it under the soil, but because they don't produce. Okay? So it is, as Aristides was saying before, a matter of sort of capabilities. So this is the geography of the renewable energy related critical raw materials production. You can see the chief producer, China. You can see also, interestingly, these are a few of these that are specific for renewable transition, but you can see that, strange, we all hear that Africa has a lot of this stuff, but is white. Why? Because it is extracted and shipped outside immediately, so no production whatsoever, although the natural reserves are very rich there, okay? And this is just the geography compared to where technologies are developed, technologies that embed this kind of materials, and you can see that is the usual suspect, okay? From the two coasts of the United States, Austin, Texas, and China, Japan, actually more Japan in this sense, and obviously South Korea and a few places in Europe. So concentration of innovation, generation of technology that we all know about. So let's go to the EU, okay? The EU, I mean, has this big umbrella now with the Open Strategic Autonomy Critical Raw Material Act, that is 2023. It was enforced in March 2024 under the Open Strategic Autonomy. We know that the Open Strategic Autonomy is a sort of direction, overarching policy scheme in order to ensure, let's say, a new system of economic governance, okay? Developing new bilateral, this is a word that I will go back to, bilateral relation, protecting, you know, technological sovereignty, protecting also the security, and trying to avoid to fall into protectionism, okay? I will then define technological sovereignty, but the priority areas, the four priority areas in the Open Strategic Autonomy are four: military and defense, energy transition, manufacturing of microchips, and de-risking critical raw material supply, which is a bit strange as a list of priorities, because de-risking critical raw materials goes into all the others. Military and defense technologies are heavily dependent on critical raw materials, as it is microchips. There are a number of acts in the last 3-4 years, industrial strategy and various other policies of the Union that, you know, incorporate the importance of the Critical Raw Material Act. Now, technological sovereignty, I mean, this also, strategic autonomy are concepts that, if you read and scan all the documents of the Commission, it's quite difficult to find a sort of, you know, unique definition. So I adopted this by a colleague, Edler, that, and other co-authors, is the ability of a state, of a federation, to provide the technologies that are critical for its welfare, competitiveness, and ability to act. act, okay? And try to sources not to be overly dependent on one source only, okay? So, these are too small, I now realize, to see, but these are the list of the European Union. It started in 2011, our first list of materials that were critical was actually quite a long time ago, up to finish with the latest one, to 2023, that incorporates materials that are, some of them are not critical. The concept of criticality is actually based on, you know, very technical measurements, and basically there are two parameters, economic importance and supply risk. Okay, these are the two properties. There are that define the criticality. Most of these are not, as I said, widespread in the planet, concentrated in, you know, places like the cobalt, 60% and more of cobalt is in one region in particular, in the southeast of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Lubumbashi area. And so, in this new list, the Commission has put materials that are not judged as critical. Copper, nickel, aluminium. But that are strategic from a policy perspective, okay? Without copper, we cannot even switch the light in this room. So think about having all the rest. So this is the list. The latest list, you can see that some of these materials are grouped, so the rare earth are light and heavy. The PGM is platinum group metals. I have to confess that in terms of interdisciplinarity, I had to collaborate now 4 years with geologists, because as an economic geographer, I was obviously getting it wrong. I was calling wrongly the materials, and, you know, to understand what is the production process from extraction to metallurgic transformation. And I learned really a lot. In the next life, probably, I will become a natural scientist. They really are amazing, I have to say. So, this is our list, and these are the targets that the Commission, in fact, put in the Critical Raw Material Act, okay? EU extraction, at least 10% of our consumption. By the way, as Europe consume 1/3 of all the materials at the moment, but we produce the 3%, okay? Then processing, at least 40% of processing has to be within the Union. EU recycling, at least 15, then they changed recently to 25 of our consumption has to come from recycling. And in terms of external sources, our dependence cannot be more than 60% of one material from one only country, which is complicated. Similar policies are implemented in the US and in the UK as part of Europe. So they put up instruments. I won't go into the details. Strategic projects that the Commission put as investment to boost investment, okay, in extraction, processing, refining, and transformation. But then the deadline were very short. There is no almost R&D in this scheme of projects, so no much money for research and innovation. European multinationals didn't participate at all. So there are schemes that support the multinational of other countries in location outside Europe. But, I mean, to do something like this with the tariffs, moreover, ballot that is going on, you need, right? I mean, no single firm, private firm would invest in something that is very long term. Okay? The other acknowledged tool is international partnership. And here, this is my personal opinion and that of my co-authors. Here we haven't seen that much. Bilateral conversation with some African countries where the EU27 was talking to Zambia or to Ghana is not for sure a sort of, you know, mutually beneficial approach. There is in the European Commission documents also the notion of like-minded economies and partners that, again, my personal opinion, as Simone Iammarino, at this point, who are the like-minded partners is something that is, it needs some thought. However, what we haven't seen is that China invited for this topic all head of state of African countries, guess when? October 2000, okay? We have 26 years where we, I would say, missed the train. So we measure this target and we had a preliminary critical assessment, and basically on this list of 60 and more elements, actually above that famous 10%, 40%, 25%, there are very few. Okay? We ask how can we actually achieve and how these targets were actually formulated on the basis of what evidence, okay? Overall, I mean, this approach is based heavily on reducing European dependence, okay? Increasing domestic extraction, domestic production, domestic recycling, without taking into account that to open a mine, if you detect a deposit, it can take on average 15 years. Okay? So, you know, there are some, and I'll show you my worries, okay? Material scarcity. We are scarce, apart from a few, okay? And these are long-term massive investment, not only in extraction, but also in mining capabilities. Geography of resources and capabilities, I'll show you, it's problematic. Geography of environmental and social costs. Now, I think that you all possibly remember, maybe because I lived in the UK for 25 years, that mines were closed in Europe, right? People didn't want mines, okay? So, and because they have environmental costs that are quite dramatic, as well as metallurgic industries, right? So, where this is gonna happen, what are the reaction of the people? It's a classical situation where people say, not in my backyard, okay? And finally, this external relationship. So this is just from our resource data set. You know, these are some of the examples. Here I have platinum, cobalt, lithium, and rare earths. And you can see that actually Europe is very badly positioned in all, okay? Africa, Latin America, and Asia are far, far more endowed. Okay, so material scarcity. Here is just the Z-scores for each material. Unfortunately, it's difficult to compare them because the kind of measures for unit of analysis of these elements, it's not compare. You cannot compare copper versus gallium, okay? So we compiled zeta score, and you can see that the red ones are competitive advantage in terms of endowment of resources, while the blue is not very good, and when there is, NP is not present, and unfortunately, Europe scores the worst, okay, at the worldwide level. Mining capabilities. Well, mining sector in Europe needs, first, mining companies that are able to operate and that are able to operate according to certain very strict, and this is good, we have strict regulation in Europe, we are great on this, but I mean, the two things are not necessarily aligned, okay? And also think about what is called social license to operate by the people that sit on these resources. Since the 70s, I was saying, this has been discarded in Europe, okay? So we have a problem of skills. And just to give you just an example, we look up patents in mining, okay? Generally, these are not green patents or anything. You can see that the rest of the world in the last years has done a lot of technological innovation in mining, while Europe is flat. Okay? So, again, how are we going to achieve all these targets where we don't have the resources or very few, and we don't have the capabilities to transform them? Okay? And now I go skipping the various mining data that it took 5 years because the European geological data infrastructure was full of holes. So one says how we can define these very specific targets without having an information base at the European level. However, this is what S&P Global gives us, okay? These are mining projects on the one hand of strategic raw materials, as they are called now, by operative status. You can see that it varies. Some mines are closed. Some mines are under development. Most of them are under development. And some are mine stage, so they extract, okay? Size classes are also different, small, medium, large mines, and so on and so forth. The pictures seem to be, not bad, but I'll show you. These are for specific, very strategic materials where the Commission put the 10% threshold in extraction. Okay, they are all below, okay? Bismuth, magnesium, manganese, platinum group, and rare earths. This is the situation. You can see the dots. You can see the dots also for Greece, right? And the copper and nickel are in Greece, and you see that there are some mines under development and mine stage. I have everything written down. And also that there are some candidate countries, and possibly this is also why we reopen this idea of an enlargement now, that are a bit better endowed. So, finally, social license to operate. This is what happens in the very, very intense exploitation of resources, particularly in the lithium triangle in Latin America and in the DRC, where, as you can see, extraction impacts, biodiversity, water pollution, soil pollution, and so on and so forth. But therefore, there are not only these situations, but also in Europe, we know, I mean, there are the cases of Covas de Barrosos in Portugal, Tregennec in France, Belgrade in Serbia, where people said, not in my backyard. Okay? Conclusion, inconsistencies between the independence target, the main goal, what we have, excessive emphasis on domestic extraction, domestic production, no provision for long-term investment, development of capabilities, R&D, risk of inefficiency and protectionism, okay? Bilateral logic with emerging and developing economies that are rich is not paying off. A lot of African economies have said, after signing a memorandum of understanding, sorry, we thought about it, no way. Okay, so, I mean, a different model of development, a different vision of relationship could have been, we are still working on this, and these are the main academic references that we already published on this. Thank you really very much for your attention.
Thank you very much, Professor Iamarino. Our discussion this night is Professor Anthony Barzokas of National Nicopolitan University of Athens.
First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me to comment on this very interesting presentation. Let me start by saying that when we observe the debate, the public discourse on critical materials, what we see is a very broad consensus. People talk about expanding demand, people talk about China, people talk about geopolitics. Today we were lucky to hear a lot of stuff and a lot of color on the context itself, which I think is very important. So what I would like to do today is I will take a more top-down approach, try to complement what we discussed so far, and I will try to keep it simple. So, what is happening in Europe, I think, is two things at the same time. Firstly, the European Union is trying to secure supply chains, but at the same time, we are revisiting economic governance per se. And I think this dual objectives create several coordination failures, or at least coordination challenges. Let me start with the first challenge. I think all the initiatives around critical materials are part and parcel of a broader initiative in Europe, which really is about the departure from the peace dividend to a new era. But at the same time, it is very clear that the premium that this era carries is not still assessed by the markets. The second coordination challenge is about the objectives themselves. When you look at the framework that is being proposed, which covers from extraction to final products, there are numbers there, their percentages. But what we are missing is that the way they are framed is ignoring that there is a fundamental sequence from step one to step three, step four. And that will create coordination challenges going forward. Another issue which is very important, I think, is that when it comes at the country level, what we observe is an asymmetry. We see countries coming forward when they command assets, but at the same time, they have limited interest in, you know, incorporating and enhancing the framework itself. So what could be done? I would say it is very important to introduce some clarity in the process itself. And in order to do that, we need to look back, because this is not happening for the first time. And we have very serious academic research explaining what happens when, in the case of rare earths, somebody is prohibiting exportation, like it happened with China in the past. So a very important and very influential study from Oxford University suggested that when that happens, we have very interesting endogenous technological development trends coming along. You can see the chart here. When China, 15 years ago, introduced the first restrictions on rare earths, we observed quite important technological development in advanced countries towards this area. So this is a very important message to carry. And if I expand further on the findings of the study, then we see that there was an innovation dimension, there was an industrial extraction dimension, and there was a welfare implication dimension. What I'm trying to say is that when you have a framework, which by definition has a sequence, you need to calibrate your priorities. And this is what Europe needs to do. Let's take it one step further. What happens with investment? You can see here the data on the global mining industry. And what I'm putting together is investment and free cash flow. The conclusion is very simple. Markets and the mining industry itself doesn't obey to policy, they follow prices. Now, leaving aside flows, let's focus on stocks. What are the concentration levels at different stages of processing for critical materials and where Europe stands? It is very interesting and a bit of strange, I would say, that when we look at Europe and allies compared to China and take the steps, Europe and its allies are really focusing on the first level, which is mining, and China is dominating processing itself. A very important message. Also, case studies have observed that there is a strong distance, like in the case of Indonesia that I refer there. There is a very interesting distance between policy narrative and what is really happening on the ground. If this is the case, what is the potential role of industrial policy, or as people say, new industrial policy? One first thing to consider is that any kind of industrial policy needs to look at prices. And the problem with these materials is that prices are not concrete, projected, and secure. You can see the difference from metal to metal in the market. And then, if we go deeper and try to look at price transparency, quality of contracts, and also the distance between the physical execution of a project and financing itself, then we see that compared to more traditional metals and mining, this cluster of products and this cluster of materials is really lacking behind on transparency, liquidity, but also funding instruments. My final point. I think there is a distance between policy framework and policy implementation. And by that I mean policy coordination. What I try to stress is that when it comes to analytics, the way the problem has been framed in Europe is very static. When it comes to industry response, we are lagging behind in competition. And when it comes to market microstructure, we need to find ways to introduce it in the implementation of policy itself. My final conclusion, I think there is some distance to carry from ambition to foundation. And I would propose three very concrete things. The first one is that we need to recalibrate the targets on the basis of demand and on the basis of more realistic quantitative objectives. The second is that it is extremely important to build some kind of counter-cyclical funding facility, because if you want to secure resources, and furthermore, if you want to upstream stockpile in the future, you need to have relevant, ready-to-use financial instruments which are not in place now. And the final point, I think the debate on new industrial policy in Europe, Draghi report, etc., they point out very carefully and very correctly the problem of coordination and coordination failures. But at the same time, we need to elaborate further and go deeper on microstructures that are facilitating these processes. And on this, we are still lagging behind. And I would say it is perhaps the mission of the academic debate to underline these problems, because these are critical issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Andori Barzokas. The floor is now open for discussion and Q&A. The discussion will be moderated by Professor Vasilis Monasteriotis.
Yes. Okay, thank you. Please indicate if you have any questions, raise your hand. Obviously, we'll pass the microphone around when you ask your question, please very briefly state your affiliation, who you are, and then ask a question as you warm up and think about how to phrase your question. Do indicate while you have one. Let me start by asking, well, first of all, thanking both Antoni and Simona for the presentation, and asking perhaps Simona if she would like to respond to the kind of the three proposals or the kind of policy recommendations in Antoni's presentation. This recalibrating the targets, sort of providing the finance structure and the coordination, are they desirable solutions and are they possible solutions?
No, I have to say that I saw Antoni's slides and before in advance, and I completely align with him. He's always more on the financial side. Actually, the question of the prices is quite interesting and important, and I'm not a finance person at all. We incorporated prices as variables in all the econometric models that we used. I skipped the technicalities in my presentation, but it is problematic. It is problematic because as this material are not commensurable among them, prices follow very, very weird logics, and sometimes, you know, volatility. Some of these materials are not on the London Stock Exchange of materials precisely because are critical. So also there, but I agree completely with him on recalibrating the target, possibly towards a more realistic kind of scenario. And the other fundamental point is finance that takes into account long-term development of capabilities and new technologies, precisely, as he shown. Thank you.
Let's move to the audience, please. Katia.
Many thanks. It was a fascinating presentation. I'd like to ask you, what is your opinion on how Europe should negotiate with China? You know that since the Mogherini time, we have said that China is either a partner or a competitor or a rival. Which of these three roles would be, let's say, more appropriate to provoke in our ways in the negotiations? And sorry, I forgot to say, my name is George Katrugalos. I'm now United Nations independent expert for the promotion of a democratic international order.
We need you desperately, I think. I think that there is no either or. China should be a partner, is a competitor. On the other hand, we've always competed with other parts of the world, right? I mean, on the European policy, there is always reference to the United States of America as a sort of benchmark, but we compete more and more with other parts of the world. Probably this should get into our mentality. Could be a rival. I would prefer China as a partner, as an open dialogue. We have, again, my personal opinion, working also with fantastic Chinese scholar that thinks like me, so it's not my, is that we have underestimated the fact that China is going to be the renewable energy and green transition leader. On the other hand, we know from history that leaderships, right, you cannot be the leader forever, and they are way advanced, and we cannot catch up, at least in the short, medium term. So I think partner would be great, opening up, listening. And this I want to tell you, just one thing. I spent 2 months in South Africa with a fellowship at the Stellenbosch University this year, and, you know, African countries and regions are aware that Chinese investment might not be always the best, let's put it in a gentle way, but they say, you know what, and this I heard from many, European comes and start talking about what they want. China comes and listen. So I think this is a good...
In the framework I presented, the negotiation with China is a very tricky business, because if you are going for price discovery and price predictability, then you have an issue. What is the time frame of negotiation? Because if you negotiate successfully, a lot of the incentives that Europe is putting together might not work, because prices will go down. And China, from the other side, can have its own time frame because they stockpiled in advance. So for Europe, this is a very challenging story, I would say. And it will be very important to have some kind of clear time frame predictability before engaging. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony. Yes, please.
Thank you very much for the presentation. My name is Thomas Androulakis, and I'm working in the mining sector for the last 35 years. To the previous point, there is a term that is used in the mining business, which is called co-opetition. And this is something that fits very well to the question with China. You need to play with both. What I have not seen in the presentations, and I would like to point out, is the prices of energy in Europe. We are talking about innovation, we are talking about scarcity of materials, whatever, but energy, which is thermodynamics, it's something that is not cheap in Europe. For instance, in Saudi Arabia or in China, they are paying 3 cents per kilowatt hour. this brings to a very bad competition-wise position Europe. Second is the capacity. In China, there is overcapacity on the products that we are talking about. Example regarding silicon coming out of quartz, not from the beaches, but from quartz, there, China has an overcapacity, 30% of the current world demand. So how you will compete with another country that has overcapacity and has so cheap energy? So for me, all the question regarding critical raw materials and strategies is finally who will pay? And if Europe is ready to subsidize energy, I don't know how they will do it in order to be competitive, because innovation, recycling, whatever, it's okay, but it's not good enough. Thank you.
I mean, you go a bit beyond my remits in the sense that there are, you know, a lot of economists, also, I mean, at the LSE in our departments that are specialized on energy market and energy prices. I agree with you. I mean, however, precisely because we are in this position that is overall relatively weak, I think we should talk to, you know, possible partners, reaching agreements. We have things to give back still in Europe. In many domains and industries, we have. We don't have the big tech of the US, and I would say I'm pleased for that, but we have rather dynamic sectors and places, and try to devise a strategy that is open, because what you say depends massively also on research that goes ahead, and precisely, I mean, the recycling thing is more, but can grow a lot, okay? And there, so, I mean, closing the debate and the dialogue, in my opinion, is counterproductive. Energy prices, I mean, we are champions in Italy because we don't have the, you know, we don't have atomic powers and plants. And this was a decision of the past that was probably wrong. It was probably wrong. We have stellar prices in energy. So, I mean, it's a complicated question that goes beyond also the specific point that we were saying. Maybe you know more about prices.
Yeah, I mean, it depends how you define the problem. If the problem is allocation of resources in general, I would say the priority is innovation. If the problem is how you calibrate a package on critical materials, then energy is part of the configuration in a way. And I would suggest that an important benchmark for that is not China, it's the US. If you compare the European versus the American initiatives on critical materials, you see the configuration there is different, the scale is more ambitious, but also what is in there is very different, including equity, which is not part of the European discourse so far.
Can we take a question here?
Thank you for the presentation. It was really fascinating. I'd like to go back to a point made by Professor Iamarino earlier. You mentioned the like-minded countries, and you wondered, you said this should be food for thought for all of us. At the end of February, the US proposed ADCM, an agreement forming a trading bloc on critical minerals. So I'd like to ask your thoughts on that. Would that be a credible alternative solution? Could that counter China?
That is exactly possibly what we don't want. I mean, why should we, I mean, you know, I have been studying European integration for now almost 4 decades. I am a product of Europe, and I left the UK, Vasilis knows, with my first line on the resignation from the LSE, saying, I'm not leaving LSE, I leave UK because of Brexit. So I believe in Europe tremendously. But going a lot around the world, working in different contexts, you really realize that we have a sort of Marshallian Plan syndrome, that we are not able to engage with realities that are there. We are trapped in a sort of, banging our head because there was once upon a time colonialism, but reapplying the same logic. And I'm sorry, but the rest of the world that is growing, and it's not only China and the US, watch India. Right, is going, this year will be growing much faster than China. And so this conversation in 5 years' time will be not possibly only about China. Latin America, Africa, the highest rates of growth now are Vietnam, Nigeria, Kenya. And we are here thinking if Trump does this, we should also, it's really, I studied before my PhD in economics, I studied international relations, political sciences, and I look at the schemes are old, surpassed, and are going probably to harm us a lot.
Yes, there is a question there.
Thanks very much for your presentation. It's very interesting. My question is, you outlined very clearly the concerns on critical material. Would you like to comment what needs to change to alleviate those concerns in view that, as far as volumes of those materials, are outside Europe, which makes it very difficult?
Come again, please.
All right. So you outlined your concerns. Would you like to comment what needs to change to alleviate those concerns you outlined in view that the volumes of the critical materials lie outside Europe, Africa, Latin America, etc.?
Well, my conclusions were very... very quick, precisely, apart from intervening indoors in the sense of thinking about a strategy of investment that is different from what has been done so far, is different international relations, really different approaches, really different. I'm a regional economist. With Vasilis, we have been thinking about, who wins, who loses about European integration, peripheries, cores and peripheries, rural versus urban. All this can be developed in a totally different development model and kind of engagement with the rest of the world that is growing and that is becoming an equal partner. And this is not my area of expertise, but I feel it strongly because you are told whenever you go somewhere else, right? We really risk to be the old good Europe that is not, is looking, backwards instead of forward. This is crucial. And in fact, there are the two areas, right? The strategic projects and the international partnership. We have been done very poorly on both of them. I'm not happy to say that, but I have.
Okay, the last question, please.
Thank you very much. Kostas Delis from the Athens University of Economics and Business and the Athena Research Center. Just a question on the beginning of your presentation, Professor Marino, you showed how you mapped specific critical materials to technologies using patents. So this bottom-up approach, do you think it has some implications for reconfiguring aspects of the smart specialization strategy? For example, in central Greece, we have the gallium-related technology. So could this mean also considering relating this density with other technology domains, that it could reshape some of the priorities?
Of absolutely, yes. I mean, thank you for these questions, because these are materials, okay? These are not intangibles. We have been focusing a lot on intangibles flows, but these are materials, so are really, really very situated. When they are there, they are there, below the soil, okay? And therefore, spurring interregional connections. There are regions in Europe, particularly in the Iberic Peninsula, Portugal, southern, and in the north, Sweden, Finland, where some very good capacities are. Greece has some, and connecting this, incentivizing interregional networks on this, in innovation, but also in sharing industrial capabilities. I'm afraid, however, that the era of the smart specialization is dead. So, if you add that everything up, it's quite worrying.
Thank you.
Okay, I thought we'd finish on a positive note, but Simona spoiled it at the end. Before I ask you to show the appreciation to the speakers in the usual way and invite you to the wine reception, let me say a few thank yous. First and foremost, thanks a lot to our sponsors. You can see the sponsors somewhere in the screen: Alpha Bank, Metlen, Piraeus Bank, and Eurobank, and Kerkira Publishers, and of course the university here. This is the end of the first year of the collaboration with the Athens University for this LSE Athens Lecture Series. So I'm very, very thankful also personally to the Vice Rector of Aristides Samitas. Thank you, Ari, but also to the university. It's been a great collaboration. We're preparing the schedule for the next year, so please keep an eye on our web pages and your emails. We will most probably resume on the week of the 2nd of November, but don't trust me on this. We will announce it. Another 3 lectures are coming. We hope that you found the topic of today and the other topics we covered this year of interest. We will continue in the same spirit on new topics in the future. Keep an eye on the activities that we do both in Greece and in London, and thank you very much to our sponsors, to our friends, to our collaborators, and obviously to the audience for making the LSE Athens Lecture Series what it is, and we believe it is a success. Now, on this note, there will be a wine reception and some food, I think, somewhere downstairs. But please join me in thanking our speakers today, Simone Marino, and our discussant, Antonis Bartzokas.
Thank you for being here with us this evening. You are warmly invited to join us at the reception hall outside.